wore a frayed sky-blue tunic over a loose black leather vest, decorated with slashes that had more to do with near misses than high fashion. Her dark hair, which piled curl upon curl, was tightly bound behind her neck, and the belt at her waist carried a minor arsenal of fighting knives and sabers. There was obvious muscle on her shoulders and arms, an impression of strength that made Locke quickly stifle his anger. "Going to what?" "Lie here on the deck," he said, "and enjoy the fine afternoon sun." The woman laughed. A second later, Jean was pulled up over the side and thrown down beside Locke. His black hair was plastered to his skull, and water streamed from the bristles of his beard. "Oh, my," said the woman. "Big one and a little one. Big one looks like he can handle himself a bit. You must be Master Valora."
"If you say so, madam, I suppose I must be."
"Madam? Madam's a sure word. Out here, to the likes of you, it's lieutenant."
"You're not the captain of this ship, then?"
The woman eased her boot off Locke's chest and allowed him to sit.
"Not even hardly," she said.
"Isri's my first," said a voice behind Locke. He turned slowly and carefully to regard the speaker.
This woman was taller than the one called Isri, and broader across her shoulders. She was dark, with skin just a few shades lighter than the hull of her ship, and she was striking, but not young. There were lines about her eyes and mouth that proclaimed her somewhere near 40. Those eyes were cold, and that mouth was hard. Clearly she didn't share Isri's sense of mischief about the two unclothed prisoners dripping water on her deck. Her night-coloured braids, threaded with red and silver ribbons, hung in a mane beneath a wide four-cornered cap, and despite the heat she wore a weather-stained brown frock coat, lined along the insides with brilliant gold silk. Most astonishingly, an elderglass mosaic vest hung unbuckled beneath her coat. That sort of armour was rarely seen outside of royal hands. Each little slat of elderglass had to be joined by a latticework of metal, since humans knew no arts to meld the glass to itself. The vest glittered with reflected sunlight, more intricate than a stained-glass window. 1,000 fingernail-sized chips of gleaming glory outlined in silver.
"Orin Ravel," she said, "I've never heard of you."
"Nor should you have," said Locke. "May we have the pleasure of your acquaintance?"
"Del," she said, turning away from Locke and Jean to look at Isri, "get that boat in. Give their clothes the eye. Take anything interesting and get them dressed again."
"Your will, Captain."
Isri turned and began giving instructions to the sailors around her.
"As for you two," the captain said, returning her gaze to the two drenched thieves, "my name is Zamira Drakasha. My ship's the Poison Orchid. And once you're dressed, someone will be along to haul you below and throw you in the bilge hold."
Chapter 9. The Poison Orchid. 1. Their prison was at the very bottom of the Poison Orchid, on what was ironically the tallest deck on the ship, a good 10 feet from lower deck to ceiling. However, the pile of barrels and oilcloth sacks crammed into the compartment left nothing but a coffin-dark crawl space above their uneven surface. Locke and Jean sat atop this uncomfortable mass of goods with their heads against the ceiling. The lightless room stank of muck-soaked orlop ropes, of mouldering canvas, of stale food and ineffective alchemical preservatives. This was technically the forward cargo stowage. The bilge proper was sealed behind a bulkhead roughly 10 feet to their left. Not 20 feet in the opposite direction, the curved black bow of the ship met wind and water. The soft waves they could hear were lapping against the ship's sides 3 or 4 feet above their heads.
"Nothing but the friendliest people and the finest accommodations on the Sea of Brass," said Locke.
"At least I don't feel too disadvantaged by the darkness," said Jean. "Lost my bloody optics when I took that tumble into the water."
"Thus far today we've lost a ship, a small fortune, your hatchets, and now your optics.
At least our setbacks are getting progressively smaller.
Jean cracked his knuckles, and the sound echoed strangely in the darkness.
"How long do you suppose we've been down here?"
"Hour, maybe." Locke sighed, pushed himself away from the starboard bulkhead, and began the laborious process of finding a vaguely comfortable niche to slide into, amidst barrel tops and sacks of hard, lumpy objects. If he was going to be bored, he might as well be bored lying down. "But I'd be surprised if they mean to keep us here for good. I think they're just marinating us for whatever comes next."
"You making yourself comfortable?"
"I'm fighting the good fight." Locke shoved a sack out of the way, and at last had enough space to rest in.
"That's better."
A few seconds later, there came the creaking tread of many pairs of feet just overhead, followed by a scraping noise. The grating to the deck above, which had been wrapped in oilcloth to seal them in darkness, was being pulled. A wan light intruded into the blackness, and Locke squinted.
"Doesn't that just figure?" he muttered.
"Cargo inspection," came a familiar voice from above. "We're looking for anything out of place. You two qualify." Jean crawled over to the pale square of light and looked up.
"Lieutenant Ezri?"
"Del Mastro," she said. "Ezri Del Mastro, hence Lieutenant Del Mastro."
"My apologies, Lieutenant Del Mastro."
"That's the spirit. How do you like your cabin?"
"Could smell worse," said Locke, "but I think I'd have to spend a few days pissing on everything to get there."
"Stay alive until our supplies start to run low," said Del Mastro, "and you'll drink some things that'll make this stench a happy memory. Now, usually I'd drop a ladder, but it's only 3 feet. I think you can manage. Come up slow. Captain Drakasha's got a sudden eagerness to have a word with you."
"Does that offer include dinner?"
"You're lucky it includes the clothes, Ravel. Get up here. Smallest first."
Locke crawled past Jean and heaved himself up through the hatch, into the moderately less stifling air of the orlop deck. Lieutenant Del Mastro waited with 8 of her crewfolk, all armed and armored. Locke was seized from behind by a burly woman as he stood up in the passageway. A moment later, Jean was helped up and held by 3 sailors.
"Right!"
Del Mastro seized Jean's wrists and snapped a pair of blackened steel manacles around them. It was Locke's turn next. She fit the cold restraints and fastened them without gentleness. Locke gave the manacles a quick professional appraisal. They were oiled and rust-free, and too tight to wriggle out of, even if he had time to make some painful adjustments to his thumbs.
"Captain's finally had a chance to talk to some of your old crew at length," said Del Mastro. "Mighty curious is what I'd call her."
"Ah, that's wonderful," said Locke. "Another fine chance to explain myself to someone. How I do so love explaining myself."
Their wary escort herded them along, and soon they were on deck in the very last light of dusk. The sun was just passing beneath the western horizon, a blood-red eye closing lazily under lids of faintly red cloud. Locke gulped the fresh air gratefully, and was again struck by the impression of population that hung about the Poison Orchid. She was crammed with crew, men and women alike, bustling about below or working on deck by the light of an increasing number of alchemical lanterns. They had come up amidships. Something clucked and fluttered in a dark box. A chicken coop, Locke realized, just forward of the mainmast. At least one bird was pecking the mesh of its cage in agitation.
"I sympathize," whispered Locke.
The Orchid crewfolk led him to the stern a few steps ahead of Jean. On the quarterdeck, just above the companionway leading down to the stern cabins, a group of sailors once again restrained Jean at some signal from Del Mastro.
"This invitation's for Ravel only," she said. "Master Valora can wait up here until we see how this is to go."
"Ah," said Locke. "Will you be comfortable up here, Jerome?"
"Cold walls do not a prison make," recited Jean with a smile, "nor iron bands a bondsman."
Lieutenant Del Mastro looked at him strangely, and after a few seconds replied,
Bold words from the tongues of the newly chained will fly, like sparks from flint, with as much real heat and as long a life.
You know the 10 honest turncoats, said Jean.
As do you. Very interesting, and completely beside the point.
She gave Locke a gentle push toward the companionway.
Stay here, Valora. Lift a finger in an unfriendly fashion, and you'll die where you stand.
My fingers will be on their best behavior.
Down the companionway, Locke stumbled into a dark space nearly the twin of that on the Red Messenger, though larger. If Locke's quick estimate was correct, the poison orchid was half again as long as his former ship. There were little canvas door cabins, two to a side, and a sturdy witchwood door to the stern cabin, currently closed tight. Ezri pushed Locke firmly aside and knocked on this door three times.
"It's Ezri with the question mark," she shouted.
A moment later the door was unbolted from within, and Del Mastro motioned for Locke to precede her. Captain Drakasha's cabin, in contrast to Ravel's, showed every evidence of long, comfortable habitation. Richly lit by faceted alchemical jewel lamps in gold frames, the space was piled with layers of tapestries and silk pillows. Several sea chests supported a lacquered tabletop covered with empty dishes, folded maps, and navigational instruments of obvious quality. Locke felt a pang when he saw his own chest wide open on the floor beside Drakasha's chair. The shutters had been drawn away from the stern windows. Drakasha sat before them, her coat and armor discarded, holding a girl of 3 or 4 on her knees. Through the windows, Locke could see the Red Messenger, shadowed in the growing darkness, crawling with the bobbing lights of what must be repair parties. Locke glanced to his left to see who'd opened the door, looked down and found himself meeting the gaze of a curly-haired boy who looked barely older than the girl held by Zamira. Both children had her coal-black hair, and something of her features, but their skin was somewhat lighter, like desert sand in shadow. Ezri tousled the boy's hair affectionately as she nudged Locke farther into the cabin, and the boy stepped away shyly.
"There," said Zamira, ignoring the newcomers for the moment and pointing out the stern windows. "Can you see that, Cosetta? Do you know what that is?"
"Ship,"
said the little girl.
"That's right,"
Zamira smiled. No, Locke corrected himself. She positively smirked.
"Mommy's new ship, from which Mommy has taken a lovely little pile of gold."
"Gold,"
said the little girl, clapping.
"Indeed. But look at the ship, love. Look at the ship. Can you tell Mommy what those tall things are? Those tall things that reach for the sky?"
"They, ha, no."
"No, you don't know? Or no, you are being mutinous?"
"Mutnast."
"Not on Mommy's ship, Cosetta. Look again. Mommy's told you what they are before, hasn't she? They reach for the sky, and they carry the sails, and they are like the..."
"Mast,"
said the girl.
"Masts, but close enough. And how many are there? How many masts does Mummy's new little ship have? Count them for Mummy."
"2.
"How clever you are. Mummy's new ship has 2 masts, yes."
Zamira leaned close to her daughter's face so that they were touching noses, and Cosetta giggled.
"Now," said Zamira, "find me something else that comes in 2.
Here
in the cabin, Cosetta. Find Mommy 2 of something."
The girl looked around, sticking most of her left hand into her mouth as she did so, before seizing upon the pair of sabers that rested in their scabbards against the wall just beneath the stern window.
"Sword,"
said Cosetta.
"That's right,"
Zamira kissed her on the cheek.
"Mommy has 2 swords, at least where you can see them, love. Now will you be a good girl and go above with Ezri? Mommy needs to speak to this man alone for just a bit. Paolo will go too."
Ezri moved across the cabin to take Cosetta into her arms, and the little girl clung to her with obvious pleasure. Paolo followed Esri like a shadow, keeping the lieutenant between himself and Locke, peeking out from behind her legs when he dared to look at all.
"You sure you want to be alone back here, Captain?"
"I'll be fine, Del. Valora's the one I'd be worried about.
He's manacled, with 8 hands standing by."
"Good enough, I think.
And the Red Messenger's men?"
"All under the forecastle. Trican's giving them the eyeball."
"Fine. I'll be along soon enough. Take Paolo and Cosetta off to Gwillam and let them sit on the quarter-deck. Nowhere near the rails, mind."
"Aye."
"And tell Gwillam that if he tries to give them unwatered beer again, I'll cut his heart out and piss in the hole."
"I'll quote that in full, Captain."
"Off with the lot of you. If you give Esri and Gwillam any trouble, loves, Mummy will not be pleased."
Lieutenant Del Mastro withdrew from the cabin, taking the 2 children and closing the door behind her. Locke wondered how to approach this meeting. He knew next to nothing about Drakasha, no weak spots to exploit, no prejudices to twist. Coming clean about the various layers of deception he was working under was probably a mistake. Best to act fully as Ravel for the time being. Captain Drakasha picked up her sheathed sabers and turned her full regard upon Locke for the first time. He decided to speak first, in a friendly fashion.
"Your children? How little escapes the penetrating insight of the veteran intelligence officer."
She slid one of her sabers out of its scabbard with a soft metallic hiss and gestured toward Locke with it.
"Sit."
Locke complied. The only other chair in the cabin was next to the table, so he settled into it and folded his manacled hands in his lap. Zamira eased herself into her own chair, facing him, and set the drawn saber across her knees.
"Where I come from," she said, "we have a custom concerning questions asked over a naked blade."
She had a distinct, harmonious accent, one that Locke couldn't place.
"Are you familiar with it?"
"No," said Locke, "but I think the meaning is clear."
"Good. Something is wrong with your story."
"Nearly everything is wrong with my story, Captain Drakasha. I had a ship and a crew and a pile of money. Now I find myself hugging a sack of potatoes in a bilge hold that smells like the bottom of an unwashed ale cup."
"Don't hope for a lasting relationship with the potatoes. I just wanted you out of the way while I spoke to some of the messenger's crewmen."
"Ah, and how is my crew?"
"We both know they're not your crew, Ravel."
"How is the crew?"
"Tolerably well, little thanks to you.
They lost the nerve for a fight as soon as they saw our numbers. Most of them seemed downright eager to surrender, so we took the messenger with nothing more than a few bruises and some hurt feelings."
"Thank you for that." "We weren't kind for your sake, Ravel. In fact, you're damned fortunate we were even nearby. I like to cruise the wake of the summer's end storms. They tend to spit out juicy morsels in no condition to refuse our hospitality."
Drakasha reached down into Locke's sea chest, shuffled the contents, and withdrew a small packet of papers.
"Now," she said, "I want to know who Leocanto Costa and Jerome de Ferra are."
"Cover identities," said Locke. "False faces we used for our work back in Talvarar."
"In the Archon service?"
"Yes."
"Nearly everything in here is signed Costa. Small letters of credit and reference. Work order for some chairs. Receipt for clothing in storage. The only document with the name Ravel on it is this commission as a Ferrari Sea officer. Should I be calling you Orin or Leocanto? Which one's the false face?"
"You might as well just call me Ravel," said Locke. "I've been on the officers' list under that name for years. It's how I drew my pay."
"Are you Ferrari born?"
"Mainland, a village called Vo Salmara."
"What did you do before you served the Archon?"
"I was what you'd call a patient man."
"Is that a profession now?"
"I mean a master of scales and balances for a merchant syndicate. I was the patient man because I did the waiting, you see?"
droll. A syndicate in Talvara?
Yes.
So you surely worked for the Priori?
That was part of the, original incentive for Stragos people to bring me into their fold. After my usefulness as an agent in the syndicate hit a wall, I was given new duties.
I spoke at length with Jabril, long enough to have no trouble believing that your naval commission really is a fake. Do you have any experience under arms?
No formal military training, if that's what you mean.
Curious, said Drakasha, that you had the authority to lay claim to a ship of war, even a small one.
When we move slowly enough to avoid upsetting anyone, captains of intelligence have excessive powers of requisition. Or at least we did. I suspect my remaining peers will be shackled with a bit of unwanted oversight because of what I've done.
Tragic. Still, it's curious again that when you were at my feet you had to ask my name. I'd have thought that my identity would be obvious to anyone in Stragos' service. How long were you with him?
5 years.
So you came after the Free Armada was lost. Nonetheless, as a Ferrari...
I had a vague description of you, said Locke. Little more than your name and the name of your ship. I can assure you, had the Archon ever thought to have your portrait painted for our benefit, no man in his service would stay ignorant of your looks.
Excellent form. But you would do well to consider me dead to flattery.
That's a pity. I'm so good at it.
A third curious thing occurs to me. You seemed genuinely surprised to see my children aboard.
It's, merely that I found it strange you'd have them with you, out here at sea, company to the hazards of all this.
Where else might I be expected to keep an eye on them?
Zemira fingered the hilt of her drawn saber. Paolo's 4, Cosetta's 3. Is your intelligence really so out of date that you didn't know about them?
Look, my job was in-city operations against the Priori and other dissenters. I didn't pay much attention to naval affairs beyond drawing my official salary.
There's a bounty of 5,000 solari on my head. Mine and every other captain that survived the war for recognition. I know that accurate descriptions of myself and my family were circulated in Talvara last year. I got my hands on some of the leaflets. Do you expect me to believe that someone in your position could be this ignorant?
I hate to sting your feelings, Captain Drakasha, but I told you. I was a landsman.
Am, and was, and my eyes were on the city. I had little enough time to study the basics of survival when I started getting ready to steal the messenger.
Why do that, though? Why steal a ship and go to sea? Something completely outside your confessed experience. If you had your eyes on the land and the city, why didn't you do something involving the land or the city?
Locke licked his lips, which had become uncomfortably dry. He'd pounded a dossier of background information on Orin Ravel into his head, but the character had never been designed for an interrogation from this perspective.
"It might sound odd," said Locke, "but it was the best I could do. As it turned out, my fake commission as a sea officer gave me the most leverage to hurt the Archon. Stealing a ship was a grander gesture than stealing, say, a carriage."
"And what did Stragos do to earn this grand gesture?"
"I've sworn an oath never to speak of the matter."
"Convenient."
"Just the opposite," said Locke, "as I wish I could put you at ease."
"At ease? How could anything you've told me put me at ease? You lie and add flourishes to old lies, and refuse to discuss your motives for embarking on an insane venture. If you won't give me answers, I have to presume that you're a danger to this vessel, and that I risk offending Maxellan Stragos by taking you in. I can't afford the consequences. I think it's time to put you back where I found you."
"The hold?"
"The open sea."
"Ah,
Locke frowned, then bit the inside of his right cheek to contain a laugh. Captain Drakasha, that was very well done. Amateurish, but creative. Someone without my history might have fallen for it.
Damn.
Drakasha smiled tightly. I should have drawn the curtains over the stern windows.
Yes, I can see your people swarming over the messenger as we speak. I presume your prize crew is unfucking the rigging so she can make more than a toddler's crawl, right? If you gave one speck of rat shit for offending the Archon, you'd be sinking that ship, not refurbishing it for sale.
True, said Drakasha.
Which means that I'm still asking questions, Ravel. Tell me about your accomplice, Master Valora. A particular friend?
An old associate. He helped me in Tal Vahrah with objectionable work.
Just an associate?
I pay him well and trust him with my business, yes.
Curiously educated.
Zamira pointed up at the cabin ceiling. A narrow skylight had vents slightly cracked to let in air from the quarterdeck.
I heard him and Ezri quoting Lucano to one another a few minutes ago.
The tragedy of the 10 honest turncoats, said Locke. Jerome is fond of it.
He can read. According to Jabril, he's not a seaman, but he can do complex sums. He speaks Vadran. He uses trader's terms and knows his way around cargo. So I'd guess that he comes from prosperous merchant stock.
Locke said nothing.
He was with you before you worked for the Archon, wasn't he?
He was a servant of the Priori, yes. It seemed that fitting Jean into Drakasha's presumptions wouldn't be as hard as Locke had feared. I brought him with me when I joined the Archon's cause.
But not as a friend.
Just a very good agent.
My appropriately amoral spy, said Drakasha.
She stood up, moved beneath the skylight, and raised her voice.
On deck there!
Aye, Captain!
Ezri's voice.
Del, bring Valora down here.
A few moments later, the door to the cabin swung open and Jean entered, followed by Lieutenant Del Mastro. Captain Drakasha suddenly unsheathed her second saber. The empty scabbards clattered to the deck, and she pointed one blade at Locke.
The instant you rise from that chair, she said, you die.
What's going...
Quiet! Ezri, I want Valora dealt with.
Your will, Captain.
Before Jean could do anything, Ezri gave him a sharp kick to the back of his right knee, so fast and well-placed that Locke winced. She followed this up with a hard shove, and Jean fell to his hands and knees.
I might still have a use for you, Ravel, but I can't let you keep your agent.
Drakasha took a step toward Jean, raising her right-hand saber. Locke was out of the chair before he could help himself, throwing himself at her, trying to tangle her arms in his manacled chain.
No!
He screamed. The cabin spun wildly around him, and then he was on the floor with a dull ache coursing through his jaw. His mind, working a second or two behind the pace of events, gradually concluded that Drakasha had bashed his chin with the hilt of one of her sabers. He was now on his back, with that saber hovering just above his neck. Drakasha seemed 10 feet tall.
"Please!" Locke sputtered. "Not Jerome! It's not necessary!" "I know," said Drakasha. "Ezri?" "Looks like I owe you 10 solari, Captain."
You should have known better, said Drakasha, grinning. You heard what Jabril had to say about these two.
I did.
Ezri knelt over Jean, a look of genuine concern on her face.
I just didn't think Ravel had it in him.
This sort of thing rarely goes just one way.
Should have known that, too.
Locke raised his hands and pushed Drakasha's blade aside. She yielded. He rolled over, stumbled to his knees, and grabbed Jean by one arm, ignoring his throbbing jaw. He knew it wasn't broken, at least. "Are you okay, Jerome?"
"Fine," said Jean. "Scrape my hands a bit."
"I'm sorry," Ezri said.
"No worries," said Jean. "That was a good hit. Not much else you could have done to knock down someone my size."
He stumbled to his feet with Locke and Ezri's help.
"A kidney punch, maybe."
Ezri showed off the set of iron knuckles around the fingers of her right hand. "That was the contingency plan."
"Damn, am I glad you didn't do that. But you could have... I might have fallen backwards if you hadn't shoved fast enough, hooking one foot around my shin from behind."
"Thought about it, or a good stiff jab to the sensitive spot in your armpit."
"And an arm twist, yeah. That would have..."
"But I don't trust that against someone so big. The leverage is wrong unless..."
Drakasha cleared her throat loudly, and Jean and Ezri fell silent, almost sheepishly.
"You lied to me about Jerome, Ravel."
She retrieved her sword belt and slid her sabers into their scabbards with a pair of sharp clacks.
"He's no hired agent. He's a friend. The sort who'd refuse to let you get thrown off a ship by yourself. The sort you'd try to protect, even though I told you it would mean your death."
"Clever," said Locke, feeling a faint warmth rising on his cheeks. "So that's what this was all about."
"More or less. I needed to know what sort of man you were before I decided what to do with you."
"And what have you decided?"
"You're reckless, vain, and too clever by half," she said. "You suffer from the delusion that your prevarications are charming, and you're just as willing as Jerome is to die stupidly on behalf of a friend."
"Yeah," he said. "Well, perhaps I've grown fond of the ugly lump over the years. Does that mean we're going back to the hold or to the open sea?"
"Neither," said Drakasha. "You're going to the forecastle, where you'll eat and sleep with all the other crewmen from the Red Messenger. I'll peel your other lies apart at leisure. For the time being, I'm satisfied that if you've got Jerome to look after, you'll be sensible."
"And so we're what? Slaves?"
"No one aboard this ship takes slaves," said Drakasha with a dangerous edge in her voice. "We do execute our fair share of smart asses, however."
"I thought I was a charming prevaricator."
"Grasp this," said Drakasha. "Your whole world consists of the few inches of empty deck I allow you, and you're goddamned lucky to have them. Ezri and I will explain the situation to all of you at the forecastle."
"And our things? The papers, I mean? The personal documents? Keep the gold, but..."
"Keep it? You really mean that? What a sweetheart this man is, Ezri."
Drakasha used her right boot to tip the cover of Locke's sea chest closed.
"Let's call your papers a hostage to your good behavior. I have a shortage of blank parchment, and two children who've recently discovered the joys of ink."
"Point thoroughly taken."
"Ezri, haul them up on deck and get their manacles off. Let's get back to acting as though we have somewhere important to be."
2. On the quarterdeck they were met by a harried-looking woman of middle years, short and broad, with a finger-length halo of white hair above the lines of a face that had obviously contributed many years of scowls to the world. Her wide, predatory eyes were in constant motion, like an owl unable to decide whether it was bored or hungry.
"You might have caught a less wretched bunch had you looked nearly anywhere," she said without preamble.
"And you might have noticed it hasn't exactly been a buyer's market for prizes recently."
Zamira bore the woman's manner with the ease of what must have been a very old familiarity.
"Well, if you want to use frayed hemp to weave a line, don't blame the rope maker when it snaps."
"I know better than to blame you for anything, scholar. It leads to weeks of misery for everyone. How many?"
28 at the forecastle," she said. 8 had to be left aboard the prize. broken bones in every case. Not safe to move them.
Will they last to Port Prodigal?
Assuming their ship does. Assuming they do as I told them, which is a bold...
That's the best we can do for them, I'm sure. Condition of the 28?
I'm sure you heard me say wretched, which derives from a state of wretchedness, which is in turn caused by their being wretches. I could use a number of other highly technical terms, only some of them completely imaginary.
Tregan, my patience is as long vanished as your good looks.
Most of them are still suffering from long enclosure. Poor sustenance, little exercise, and nervous malaise. They've been eating better since leaving Talvarar, but they're exhausted and battered. A handful are in what I'd call decent health. An equal number are not fit for any work at all until I say otherwise. I won't bend on that, Captain.
I won't ask you to. Disease?
Miraculously absent, if you mean fevers and contagions. Also little by way of sexual consequences. They've been locked away from women for months, and most of them are Eastern Therin. Very little inclination to lie with one another, you know.
Their loss. If I have further need of you...
I'll be in my cabin, obviously. And mind your children. They appear to be steering the ship.
Locke stared at the woman as she stamped away. One of her feet had the hollow, heavy sound of wood, and she walked with the aid of a strange cane made of stacked white cylinders. Ivory? No, the spine of some unfortunate creature fused together with shining seams of metal. Dracasha and Del Mastro turned toward the ship's wheel, a doubled affair like the one aboard the messenger, currently tended by an unusually tall young man who was all sharp, gangling angles. At either side stood Paolo and Cosetta, not actually touching the wheel, but mimicking his movements and giggling.
"Mumchance," said Dracasha as she stepped over and pulled Cosetta away from the wheel. "Where's Gwillem?"
"Crap lines."
"I told him he was on Sprat duty," said Esri.
"I'll have his fucking eyes," said Dracasha.
Mumchance seemed unruffled.
"Man's got a piss, Captain."
"Got a piss," mumbled Cosetta.
"Hush." Zamira reached around Mumchance and snatched Paolo back from the wheel as well.
"Mum, you know full well they're not to touch the wheel or the rails."
"They wasn't touching the wheel, Captain."
"Nor are they to dance at your side, cling to your legs, or in any other way assist you in navigating the vessel. Clear?"
"Savvy."
"Paolo," said Dracasha, "take your sister back to the cabin and wait for me there."
"Yes,"
said the boy, his voice as faint as the sound of two pieces of paper sliding together. He took Cosetta's hand and began to lead her aft. Dracasha hurried forward once again, past small parties of crew folk working or eating, all of whom acknowledged her passing with respectful nods and waves. Esri pushed Locke and Jean along in her wake. Near the chicken coops, Dracasha crossed paths with a rotund but sprightly Vadran a few years older than herself. The man was wearing a dandified black jacket covered in tarnished brass buckles, and his blonde-grey hair was pulled into a billowing ponytail that hung to the seat of his breeches. Dracasha grabbed him by the front of his tunic with her left hand.
"Gwillem, what part of 'watch the children for a few minutes' did Esri fail to make clear?"
"I left them with Mum, Captain."
"They were your problem, not his."
"Well, you trust him to steer the ship. Why not trust him to—"
"I do trust him with my loves, Gwillem. I just have a peculiar attachment to having orders followed."
"Captain,"
said Gwillem in a low voice, "I had to drop some brown on the blue, eh? I could have brought them to the crap lines, but I doubt you would have approved of the education they'd have received."
"Hold it in, for Yono's sake. I only took a few minutes,"
Now go pack your things.
My things?
Take the last boat over to the messenger and join the prize crew.
Prize crew? Captain, you know I'm not much good.
I want that ship eyeballed and inventoried, bowsprit to taffrail. Account for everything. When I haggle with the shipbreaker over it, I want to know exactly how far the bastard is trying to cheat me.
But
I'll expect your written tally when we rendezvous in Port Prodigal. We both know there was hardly any loot to sling over and count today. Get over there and earn your share.
Your will, Captain.
My quartermaster, Zamira said when Gwillem had trudged away, swearing. Not bad, really. Just prefers to let work sort of elude him whenever possible. At the bow of the ship was the forecastle deck, raised perhaps 4.5 feet above the weather deck, with broad stairs on either side. In between those stairs, a wide, uncovered opening led to a dark area that was half compartment and half crawl space beneath the forecastle. It was 7 or 8 yards long, by Locke's estimate. The forecastle deck and stairs were crowded with most of the Red Messenger's men, under the casual guard of half a dozen of Zamira's armed crewfolk. Jabril, sitting next to Aspel at the front of the crowd, seemed deeply amused to see Locke and Jean again. The men behind him began to mutter.
"Shut up!"
said Ezri, taking a position between Zamira and the newcomers. Locke, not quite knowing what to do, stood off to one side with Jean and waited for instructions. Drakasha cleared her throat.
"Some of us haven't met. I'm Zamira Drakasha, captain of the Poison Orchid. Lend an ear. Jabril told me that you took ship in Talvara thinking you were to be pirates. Anyone having second thoughts?"
Most of the messenger's men shook their heads or quietly muttered denials.
"Good. I am what your friend Ravel pretended to be," Drakasha said, reaching over and putting one of her arms around Locke's shoulders. She smiled theatrically, and several of the messenger's less battered men chuckled. "I have no lords or masters. I fly the red flag when I'm hungry and a false flag when I'm not. I have one port of call, Port Prodigal in the Ghost Winds. Nowhere else will have me. Nowhere else is safe. You live on this deck. You share that peril. I know some of you don't understand. Think of the world. Think of everywhere in the world that isn't this ship, save one rotten little speck of misery in the blackest asshole of nowhere. That's what you're renouncing. Everything. Everyone. Everywhere." She released Locke and seemed to note the somber expressions of the messenger's crew with approval. She pointed at Ezri.
"My first mate, Ezri Del Mastro. We call her Lieutenant, and so do you. She says it, I back it. Never presume otherwise. You've met our ship's physica. Scholar Tregan tells me you could be worse and you could be better. There'll be rest for those that need it. I can't use you if you're in no condition to work."
"Are we being invited to join your crew, Captain Drakasha?" asked Jabril.
"You're being offered a chance," said Ezri. "That's all. After this, you're not prisoners, but you're not free men. You're what we call the Scrub Watch. You sleep here, in what we call the Undercastle. Worst place on the ship, more or less. If there's a filthy shit job to be had, you'll do it. If we're short blankets or clothes, you'll go without. You're last for meals and drinks."
"Every member of my crew can give you an order," said Drakasha, picking up as Ezri finished. Locke had a notion that they'd honed this routine together over time. "And every one of them will expect to be obeyed. We've no formal defaults. Cop wise or slack off, and someone will just beat the hell out of you. Raise enough fuss that I have to notice, and I'll throw you over the side. Think I'm kidding? Ask someone who's been here a whiles."
"How long do we have to be on the scrub watch?" asked one of the younger men near the back of the crowd.
"Until you prove yourselves," said Drakasha. "We raise anchor in a few minutes and sail for Port Prodigal. Anyone who wants to leave when we get there, be gone. You won't be sold. This isn't a slaving ship. But you'll get no pay save drink and rations. You'll walk away with empty pockets, and in Prodigal, slavery might be kinder. At least someone would give a shit that you lived or died. If we cross paths with another sail on the way down," she continued, "I'll give thought to taking her. And if we fly a red flag, that's your chance. You'll go in first. You'll board the prize before any of us. If there's fire or bows or razor nets or gods know what, you'll taste it first and bleed first. If you survive, grand, your crew. If you refuse, we dump you in Port Prodigal. I only keep a scrub watch on hand as long as I have to." She nodded to Ezri.
"As of now," said Del Mastro, "you can have the forecastle and the weather deck far back as the mainmast. Don't go below or touch a tool without instructions. Touch a weapon or try to take one from one of the crew, and I guarantee you'll die on the instant. We're touchy about that. You want to get cozy with a member of the crew, or they offer to get cozy with you? Do what you will as long as you're off duty and you stay off the bloody weather deck. Out here, what's given is given. You try to take something by force, you'd better pray you die in the attempt, because we're touchy about that, too."
Zamira took over again and pointed at Locke and Jean. "Ravel and Valora will be rejoining you." A few of the men grumbled, and Zamira rested her hands on her saber hilts. "Mind your fucking manners. You put them over the side and vowed to let Yono be their judge. I showed up about an hour later. That settles that. Anyone who thinks they know better than the Lord of the Grasping Waters can jump over the rail and take it up with him in person."
"They're scrub watch like the rest of you," said Ezri.
Still, the men didn't seem particularly enthusiastic, and Zamira cleared her throat.
"This is an equal shares ship."
That got their attention.
"Ship's quartermaster goes by the name of Gwilym. He counts the take. 30% goes to the ship so we don't slink about with rotting canvas and cordage. Rest gets split evenly, one share per beating heart. You don't touch a centira from what we already took out of your old ship. No apologies there. But if you get your chance on the way to Port Prodigal, and your crew when we sell the messenger off to the shipbreaker, you'll get a share of that, and that'll set you up nicely. If your crew."
Locke had to admire her for that. It was a sensible policy, and she'd brought it into the lecture at a moment calculated to deflect dissension and worry. Now the Red Messenger wouldn't just be an unhappy memory vanishing over the horizon in the hands of a prize crew. It might be a waiting pile of silver. Zamira turned and headed aft, leaving Del Mastro to finish the show. As murmurs of conversation began to rise, the petite lieutenant yelled,
"Shut up! That's the business, then! There'll be food in a while, and a half ration of beer to settle you down some. Tomorrow I'll start sorting those of you with particular skills and introducing you to some work. There's one last thing the captain didn't mention."
Ezri paused for several seconds and made sure that everyone was listening attentively.
"The younger Drakashas. Captain has a boy and a girl. Mostly they're in her cabin, but sometimes they've got the run of the ship. What they are to you is sacred. I mean this more than I mean anything else I've said tonight. Say so much as an unkind word to them, and I'll nail your cock to the foremast and leave you there to die of thirst. The crew thinks of them as family. If you have to break your neck to keep them safe, then it's in your best interest to break your bloody neck."
Del Mastro seemed to take everyone's silence as a sign that they were duly impressed, and she nodded. A moment later, Drakasha's voice sounded from the quarterdeck, magnified by a speaking trumpet.
Up anchor!
Del Mastro lifted a whistle that hung around her neck on a leather cord and blew it 3 times.
At the waist! She hollered in an impossibly loud voice. Ship capstan bars! Stand by to raise anchor! Scrub watch to the waist, as able!
At her urging, most of the messenger's former crew rose and began shuffling toward the orchid's waist. A large work party was already gathering there between the foremast and the chicken coops, fitting long capstan bars in their places by lantern light. A woman was scattering sand on the deck from a bucket. Locke and Jean fell in with Jabril, who smiled wryly.
"Evening, Ravel. You look a bit demoted."
"I'm happy enough," said Locke. "But honestly, Jabril, I'll leave the messenger in your hands for, what, an hour? And look what happens."
"It's a bloody improvement," said someone behind Locke.
"Oh, I agree," said Locke, deciding that the next few days might be infinitely more pleasant for everyone if Ravel were to swallow anything resembling pride over his brief career as a captain.
"I agree with all my God's damned heart."
Esri shoved her way through the gathering crowd and vaulted atop the capstan barrel. It was wide enough that she could sit cross-legged upon it, which she did. She blew her whistle twice more and yelled,
"Rigged below!
Rigged below!"
rose an answering cry from one of the hatches.
"Take your places!" said Esri.
Locke squeezed in next to Jean and leaned against one of the long wooden bars. This capstan was wider than the one aboard the messenger, and an extra 20 or so sailors could easily crowd in to work it. Every place was filled in seconds.
"Right!" said Esri. "Heave! Slow to start! Heave! Slow to start! Feet and shoulders! Faster now! Make the little bitch spin round and round! You know you want to!"
Locke heaved at his bar, feeling the grit shift and crunch beneath him, poking uncomfortably at the sensitive spots between his toes and the balls of his bare feet. But nobody else seemed to be complaining, so he bit his lip and bore it. Esri was indeed spinning round and round. Clank by clank, the anchor cable was coming in. A party formed at the larboard bow to secure it. After several minutes of shoving, Esri brought the capstan party to a halt with one short blast on her whistle.
"Vast heaving!" she cried. "Secure larboard anchor!"
"Cast to the larboard tack!" came Drakasha's amplified voice. "Fore and main topsails!"
More running, more whistles, more commotion. Esri hopped to her feet atop the capstan and bellowed a quick succession of orders.
"Hands aloft to loose fore and aft topsails! Brace main yards round for the larboard tack! 4 yards braced a box!"
There was more, but Locke stopped listening as he tried to make sense of what was happening. The poison orchid had been drifting by a single anchor in a calm sea, with a light breeze out of the northeast, and she'd drifted down so that the wind was dead ahead. What little he understood of Esri's orders told him that the ship would be slipping a bit aback, then turning east and bringing the wind over her larboard bow.
"Fore and aft watches at the rails! Top eyes wide awake now!"
Esri leapt down onto the deck. Dark shapes were surging up the ratlines hand over hand. Blocks and tackles creaked in the growing darkness, and still more crew were coming up through the hatches to join the tumult.
"Scrub watch! Scrub watch! Get to the undercastle and stay out of the bloody way!"
"Not you two!"
Esri grabbed Locke and Jean as they moved with the messenger's men, and she pointed them aft.
"Tool locker, under the starboard stairs abaft the mainmast. Get brooms and sweep all this sand back into its bucket. After you unship the capstan bars."
They did just that. Tedious work by wavering alchemical light, frequently interrupted by busy or discourteous crewfolk. Locke worked with a scowl until Esri stepped up between him and Jean and whispered,
"Don't mind this. It'll make things a hell of a lot easier with your old crew."
Damned if she wasn't right, Locke thought.
A little extra humiliation heaped on Ravel and Valora might be just the thing to stifle the old crew's resentment.
"My compliments," he whispered.
"I know my business," she said brusquely. "See everything back to where you found it, then go to the Undercastle and stay there." Then she was gone, into the work parties overseeing a dozen delicate operations. Locke returned the brooms to the tool locker, then threaded his way forward with Jean just behind. Overhead, canvas snapped and rolled, ropes creaked as strain was added or adjusted, and men and women called softly to one another as they worked with nothing but thin air for dozens of yards beneath them. The poison orchid slid slowly onto the larboard tack. She put the last faint halo of the lost sun behind her, as though sailing out of some ghostly golden portal, and gathered way beneath the first stars of evening, which waxed steadily brighter in the inky eastern sky. Locke was pleasantly surprised to discover that Jabril had held a spot for him and Jean. Not one of the more desirable ones near the entrance to the Undercastle, but enough spare deck to squeeze up against the larboard bulkhead in relative darkness. Others, with more favourable positions, seemed not to begrudge them a moment of space as they crawled and stumbled past. One or two men muttered greetings. At worst, a few, like Mazuka and Aspel, maintained an unfriendly silence.
"Looks like you two really have joined the rest of us galley-slaves," said Jabril.
"Galley-slaves is what we'd be if Ravel hadn't gotten us out of Windward Rock," said someone Locke didn't recognize. "Maybe a dumb fuck, but we should show him fellowship for that."
"Thanks for speaking up when we were being thrown off the ship," Locke thought.
"Aye, I agree about the dumb fuck part," said Mazuka.
"And we'll all mind the fellowship part," said Jean, using the slow, careful voice he reserved for people he was trying to avoid hitting. "Orin's not alone, is he?"
"Dark in here," said Mazuka. "Lots of us squeezed in together. You think you can move fast enough, Valora? You think you can stay awake long enough for it to matter? 28 on 2.
"If it was clear deck between you and me," said Jean, "you'd piss your britches the moment I cracked my knuckles."
"Jerome," said Locke, "easy. We can all..."
There was the sound of a scuffle in the darkness, and a heavy thud. Mazuka gave a strangled squawk.
"Baldy, you stupid bastard!" hissed an unknown voice. "You raise a hand against them and Drakasha will kill you, savvy?"
"You'll make it worse for all of us," said Jabril. "You never heard of Zamira Drakasha? Piss her off and we might lose our chance to be crew. You do that, Mazuka. You find out what 28 on 1 feels like. Fucking promise."
There were murmurs of agreement in the darkness, and a sharp gasp as whoever had been holding Mazuka let go.
"Peace," he gasped. I won't ruin things. Not me."
The night was warm, and the heat of 30 men in close confinement rapidly grew stifling despite the small ventilation grating in the middle of the forecastle deck. As Locke's eyes adjusted to the darkness, he became able to pick out the shadowed shapes of the men around him more clearly. They lay or sat flank to flank like livestock. The ship reverberated with activity around them. Feet pounded the forecastle deck. Crewfolk moved about and laughed and shouted on the deck below. There was a slapping hiss of waves parting before the bow, and the constant sound of toil and shouted orders from aft. In time, there was a cursory meal of lukewarm salted pork and a half a leather jack of skunkish swill vaguely descended from ale. The food and drink were passed awkwardly through the crowd. Knees and elbows met stomachs and foreheads on a continual basis until everyone was dealt with. Then came the equally punishing task of passing jacks and tin bowls back, and then of men crawling over one another to use the crap lines. Locke finally settled for good into his sliver of deck space against Jean's back, and had a sudden thought.
"Jabril, did anyone find out what day it is?"
"12th of Festal," said Jabril.
I asked Lieutenant Del Mastro when I was brought aboard.
12 days, muttered Jean.
Yeah, Locke sighed. 12 days gone. Not 2 weeks since they'd set out, with every man here deferring to him and Jean as heroes. 12 days for the antidote to wane in strength. Gods, the Archon! How the hell was he going to explain what had happened to the ship? Some nautical technicality?
Squiggle fucked the rightwise cockswabber with a starboard jib, he whispered to himself, when I should have used a larboard jib.
What? Muttered Jean and Jibril simultaneously.
Nothing.
Soon enough, the old instincts of a catchfire orphan asserted themselves. Locke made a pillow of the crook of his left arm and closed his eyes. In moments, the noise and heat and bustle of the men around him, and the thousand noises of the unfamiliar ship, were nothing more than a vague background to his light but steady sleep. Chapter 10 All Souls in Peril 1 By the 17th of Festal, Jean had come to dread the sight and smell of the ship's vinegar as much as he'd come to appreciate his glimpses of her lieutenant. His morning task, on most days, was to fill one bucket with the foul red stuff and another with seawater, and set to swabbing the deck and bulkheads along the full length of the main deck, at least where he could reach. Fore and aft were long compartments called crew berths, and one would be in use at any given time, crammed with 4 or 5 dozen people in and out of hammocks, their snores mingling like the growls of caged beasts. That berth Jean would carefully avoid, instead swabbing out ship's stores, what the crew called the delicates room, for its rack of glass bottles under netting, the main deck hold and armoury, and the empty crew berth, though even when empty each berth contained a mess of barrels, crates and nettings that had to be laboriously shifted. Once the reek of watered vinegar was fully mingled with the usual below-deck stench of old food, bad liquor and all things unwashed, Jean would usually move throughout the lowest 2 decks, the orlop and the bilge, swinging a large yellow alchemical light before him to help dissipate the miasmas that caused disease. Drakasha was a great one for the health of her crew. Most of the sailors pierced their ears with copper to ward off cataracts and drank pinches of white sand in their ale to strengthen their bellies against rupture. The lower decks were lighted at least 2x a day, much to the amusement of the ship's cats. Unfortunately, this meant climbing, crawling, scrambling, and shoving past all manner of obstacles, including busy crewfolk. Jean was always careful to be polite and make his obeisance by nodding as he passed. This crew was always in motion. This ship was always alive. The more Jean saw and learned on the poison orchid, the more convinced he became that the maintenance schedule he'd set as first mate of the Red Messenger had been hopelessly naive. No doubt Caldrus would have spoken up eventually, had he lived long enough to notice. There seemed to be no such thing, in Captain Drakasha's opinion, as a state of adequate repair for a ship at sea. What was checked or inspected one watch was checked again the next, and the next, day after day. What was braced was then rebraced. What could be mended was remended. The pump and capstan mechanisms were greased daily with fat scraped from the cooking pots. The masts were slushed top to bottom with the same brown gunk for protection against the weather. Sailors wandered in constant attentive parties, inspecting plank seams or wrapping canvas around rigging where the ropes chafed against one another. The orchids were divided into 2 watches, red and blue. They would work in 6-hour shifts, one watch minding the ship while the other rested. The red watch, for example, had duty from noon till the 6th hour of the evening, and would come back on duty from midnight till the 6th hour of the morning. Crew on the off watch could do as they pleased, unless the call of all hands summoned them to the deck for some strenuous or dangerous undertaking. The scrub watch didn't fit into this scheme. The former men of the Red Messenger were worked from dawn to dusk,
and took their meals after they were dismissed, rather than around noon with the actual crew. For all their grumbling, Jean didn't get the sense that the orchids genuinely resented their new shipmates. In fact, he suspected that the ex-messengers were taking up most of the less interesting chores, leaving the orchids that much more time to sleep, or mend personal effects, or gamble, or fuck without a hint of shame in their hammocks or under their blankets. The lack of privacy aboard ship was still a major astonishment to Jean. He was neither a prude nor a virgin, but his idea of the right place had always involved stone walls and a firmly locked door. A lock would mean little on a ship like this, where most any noise was a shared noise. There were a pair of men on the Blue Watch who could be heard from the taffrail if they were doing it in the forward berth, and a woman on the Red Watch who screamed the damnedest things in Vadran, usually just as Jean was drifting off to sleep on the deck above her. He and Locke had puzzled over her grammar and concluded that she didn't actually speak Vadran. Sometimes her performances were followed by applause. That aside, the crew seemed to take pride in their discipline. Jean witnessed no fights, few serious arguments, and no out-of-place drunkenness. Beer or wine was had in a respectable fashion at every meal, and by some complicated scheme that Jean had yet to work out, each member of the crew was allowed, about once a week, to go on what was called the Merry Watch, a sort of watch within a watch. The Merry Watch would set up on the main deck and be allowed a bit of freedom at the ship's waist, especially for throwing up. They could drink more or less as they saw fit, and were excused even from all-hands calls until they'd recovered.
"It's not exactly what I expected," said Jean, as Ezri stood at the larboard rail one morning, pretending not to watch him touch up the grey paint on the bottom of the ship's smallest boat. She did that every now and again. Was he imagining things? Was it his quoting Lucano? He'd avoided quoting anything else at her, even when the opportunity had presented itself. Better to be a mystery, in his book, than to make a cheap refrain of something that had caught her attention.
13 gods, he thought with a start. Am I angling myself for a pass at her? Is she...
Pardon? She said.
Jean smiled. Somehow he'd guessed she wouldn't mind his speaking without invitation.
Your ship. It's not exactly what I expected, from what I read.
From what you read?
She laughed, crossed her arms, and regarded him almost slyly.
What did you read?
Let me think.
He dipped his brush in the grey alchemical slop and tried to look busy.
7 years between the gale and the lash.
Benedictus Montcalm, she said. Read that one. Mostly bullshit. I think he traded drinks for stories off real sailors until he had his fill.
How about True and Accurate History of the Wanton Red Flag?
Suzette Villaducasi. I know her.
Know her?
Know of her. Crazy old bitch wound up in Port Prodigal. Scribes for coppers, drinks every coin she gets. Barely speaks decent Therin anymore. Just haunts the gutter and curses her old publishers.
Those are all the books I can remember, said Jean. Not much of a taste for histories, I'm afraid. So, how did you manage to read everything you have?
Ah, she said, tossing her hair backward with a flick of her neck. She wasn't scrawny, thought Jean. No angles on Ezri, just healthy curves and muscle. Had to be healthy to knock him down as she had, even by surprise.
Out here, the past is a currency, Jerome. Sometimes it's the only one we have.
Mysterious.
Sensible.
You already know a bit about me.
And fair's fair, is it? Thing is, I'm a ship's officer, and you're a dangerous unknown.
That sounds promising.
I thought so, too, she smiled. More to the point, I'm a ship's officer, and you're Scrubwatch. You're not even real yet.
She framed him with her hands and squinted.
You're just a sort of hazy something on the horizon.
Well, he said, and aware that he sounded like a nitwit even as he repeated himself,
Ah, well. But you were curious.
I was.
About the ship?
Oh, yeah, I was. I just wondered, now that I've seen a fair bit of it.
Where's the singing? Where's the dancing on the yardarms? Where's the ale casks fore and aft? Where's the drinking and puking sunrise to sunset?
More or less. Not exactly a navy, you know.
Drakasha is former navy. Cyrune. She doesn't talk about it much, but she doesn't try to hide her accent any more. She did once.
Cyrune, thought Jean, an island empire even more easterly than Jerem and Jeresh. Proud and insular, dark-skinned folk who took their ships seriously. If Drakasha was one of them, she'd come from a tradition of sea officers that some said was as old as the Therin throne.
Cyrune, he said.
That explains some things. I thought the past was a currency.
She'd have let you have that bit for free, said Ezri. Trust me, if history's a coin, she's sitting on a god's damned fortune.
So she, bends the ship to her old habits?
More like we let ourselves be bent.
Ezri gestured to him to keep painting, and he returned to work.
Brass sea captains are special. They have status, on the water and off. There's a council of them in Prodigal, but each ship, the brethren sort of go their own way. Some captains get elected. Some only rule when it's time to take arms. With Drakasha, she rules because we know she's our best chance. At anything, they don't fuck around in Cyrune.
So you keep naval watches and drink like nervous husbands and mind your manners?
You don't approve?
God's blood, I damn well approve. It's just tidier than I imagined is all.
You wouldn't call anything we do naval if you'd ever served on a real ship of war. Most of our crew have, and this is a slacker's paradise by comparison. We keep our habits because most of us have been aboard other pirate ships too. Seen the leaks that gain a little bit every day. Seen the mechanisms rusting. Seen the rigging fraying. What good slacking all the time if the ship comes apart beneath you while you sleep?
So you're a prudent bunch.
Yeah. Look, the sea either makes you prudent or it kills you. Drakasha's officers take an oath. We're sworn that this ship goes down in battle or by the will of the gods, not for want of work or canvas or cord. That's a holy vow. She stretched. And not for want of paint, either. Give the whole thing another coat and look sharp about it.
Officers. Jean reviewed the Orchid's officers as he worked, to keep his mind off Ezri. There was Drakasha, obviously. She kept no watch, but appeared when and as she saw fit. She seemed to be on deck at least half the day, and materialized like magic when anything interesting happened. Beneath her, Ezri. Damn it, no thoughts concerning Ezri, not now. Mum Chance, the sailing master, and his little crew of trusted wheelhands. Drakasha might allow ordinary crewfolk to hold the helm in steady weather, but for any operation of skill, it was Mum and his bunch or nobody. Roughly equal with Mum were the quartermaster, currently assigned to the Red Messenger, and the physicker, Tregan, who would likely never admit to being equal with anyone who didn't have a temple with their name on it. Drakasha had the great cabin, naturally, and the four highest officers were allowed little closet rooms in the companionway, canvas-walled things like his old cabin. Then there was a carpenter, a sailmaker, a cook, and a boatswain. The only privilege of being a petty officer seemed to be the right to boss a few other crewfolk about from time to time. There was also a pair of under-lieutenants, Jean supposed. Ezri called them her watch chiefs, and they were Ezri when Ezri wasn't around. Utgar had the red watch, and a woman called Nazreen led the blue, but Jean had yet to meet her, since she'd been entrusted with the messenger's prize crew. It seemed that all the menial back-and-forth mucking about was giving Jean, and the rest of the scrub watch, the chance to learn the ship's hierarchy, along with its layout,
He supposed that was by design. The weather had been consistent since their capture. Steady, light breezes from the northeast, clouds that came and went like a tavern dancer's favour, endless low waves that made the sea gleam like a million-faceted sapphire. The sun was a pounding heat by day, and enclosure stifled them at night, but Jean was conditioned to this work by now. He was as brown as Paolo and Cosetta. Locke, too, seemed to be making the best of it, tanned and bearded and genuinely wiry for once, rather than merely slender. His size and an unwise boast about his agility had gotten him assigned to mast-slushing duty, foremast and main, each and every morning. Their food still came late after each long day, and though charmless, it was more than ample. They had a full liquor ration now, too. As much as Jean hated to admit it, even to himself, he didn't mind this turn of events so very much. He could work and sleep in confidence that the people ruling the ship knew their business. He and Locke no longer had to run everything on improvisation and prayer. If not for the damned log, with its relentless record of day after day passing them by, day after day of the antidote waning, it would have been a good time. A good and timeless interval with Lieutenant Del Mastro to puzzle over. But neither he nor Locke could stop counting the days. 2. On the 18th of Festal, Bald Mazooka snapped. He'd given no warning. Though he'd been sullen in the undercastle each night, he was one among many tarred and short-tempered men, and he'd made no further threats toward anyone, crew